On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Welcome back. Gavin Riley with you on the record this Sunday afternoon, 53106 for your text. On the record NT is our hashtag on Twitter. Now, calls for a travel ban, hostility to visitors moving between countries, the closure of schools, everyone not really knowing what's going to happen to the GAA season. It's not 2020. It's not 2021. It's the story of the polio epidemic in Cork in 1956. Now, thankfully, the mid-50s polio epidemic, it ended with the distribution pretty rapidly of a vaccine. So maybe there is an omen there. But it wasn't easy to get everyone to take it. And on a global level, it took celebrities like Elvis Presley doing his piece on The Ed Sullivan Show to actually get the public behind vaccination. But the story of the polio vaccine, which includes Pfizer nonetheless, is one of the great success stories of the 1950s. And Donal Fallon, having pulled yet another gem out of the historical archives, is back to tell us all about it. Donal, good afternoon. How are you?
Good to be here. I look forward to this phone call every week and human interaction.
Well, I'm glad to be able to offer some sort of semblance to your Sundays. Not unlike in our own time, interference with the GAA season is one of the things that people really recall around the polio epidemic.
Absolutely. And, you know, whatever about the loss of the O'Byrne Cup and the like, I think most of us are praying for kind of zero interference this year into the summer in September with the GAA. And a return to All-Ireland normality would be very, very nice, even if we can't all attend the match. That remains to be seen. But, you know, looking back on the 20th century, you can kind of see moments of great difficulty in Ireland's history and sometimes the broader human story when you look at interference with the national games. The Spanish flu pandemic pushed the All-Ireland final back. The War of Independence both impacted, you know, our ability to see a GAA season to conclusion. And then in 1956, something really remarkable happened. Cork qualified for both finals, football and hurling. Unfortunately for the Leasiders, they lost both of them, which was pretty reflective of the year that they had. But the football final was played in October, which was then totally unimaginable. I mean, if you told someone even, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, there'd be a Christmas All-Ireland, no one would believe you. But in the 50s...
Well, I remember the Mayo fans a couple of years ago saying that because one of their replays against Dublin was on a Saturday in October, that suddenly the curse wasn't valid because the curse only applied to Sundays in September.
That's brilliant. But in 56, they played the football final in October as a result of pressure from kind of public health officials in Dublin, fearful of kind of large crowds of spectators from Cork travelling to the capital. Some even called for the game to play behind closed doors. And there's this brilliant angry letter that appears in the press from a Dubliner. Let Cork's own team keep their polio and not infect our clean city. The minister must wake up and do something before the polio of the Corkonians is laid upon us. So that sets the scene. You know, such was the fear of polio in 1956.
Yeah, you could just copy and replace Italian fans coming to Dublin for the Six Nations last March, and it suddenly seems very similar. By the way, the great loss of the O'Byrne Cup is that non-Dublin teams in Leinster now don't have a chance of winning anything, because that's the only silverware we might actually get a grip on. In terms of numbers, by modern days it might seem minuscule, but the fear of polio was really very real at the time.
Yeah, make no mistake about it. I mean, the numbers, by comparison to what we know now, are minuscule. But I mean, the effects of polio could be long term. And there are still people, you know, in Ireland today, survivors of the 1956 polio pandemic, who live with the effects of it. So fear was great. And Lawrence Geary, the historian, has really looked at polio in Ireland and its arrival. He notes that it only actually became a notifiable disease here in 1941. So it was a relatively new thing. And it terrified people because initially it seemed that it had very, very high fatality rates. But in retrospect, I think, to be honest, what that probably represented was just massive under-reporting. Like in 42, for example, the first wave of polio in this country, there were 487 cases and 133 deaths notified to the Department of Health. So, you know, the fear around this illness was very, very real indeed. And because it had only arrived in the 40s, there were still questions into the mid-50s. How does it spread? You know, and where does it even come from?
And I suppose in a converse to what we've already been talking about already in this show, when we're talking about the condition of the day, this was one which seemed, and still does largely, to spread primarily among children.
Yeah, and that's quite remarkable about it even today. It's an infectious disease spread from person to person, primarily children, in a number of manners. But I mean, it's a living threat to the world today. And we should remember that. Like, polio might be a historical memory in Dublin and in Ireland, it might be largely eradicated in this part of the world, but you still get outbreaks of it in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan in recent times. But I think the great fear around polio was that in some cases, less than 1% of cases, but you know, significant enough numbers of cases. It had the potential to affect the central nervous system. It could lead to muscle weakness and paralysis. So those affected could spread the disease for weeks, even if they displayed no symptoms. That's a familiar tale to areas, of course, and something that greatly contributed to the fear around it. But the good fortune of Ireland, as we get into today, is that our very significant outbreak in the second half of the 50s coincided exactly with the emergence of a vaccine. And I think it's fair to say the distribution of that vaccine in Ireland in the 1950s is one of the great success stories of kind of 20th century Irish medical history.
And we'll come to that in just a minute. But I suppose then what's remarkable when you talk about the timing of the outbreak in Ireland, that means that the outbreak, which was in Ireland and particularly in Cork this time, it was probably not only the last in Ireland, but pretty much the last major one in Europe, really.
Yeah, Cork has the dubious honour of being the last significant outbreak of the disease in Europe. And despite the fact that this was a big, big story in its day, there's very few kind of first-hand accounts of it. And that's not all that unusual, to be honest. That's true with cholera. It's true with Spanish flu. Generally, people that are living through history, they don't kind of stop to record it. You know, they don't write their day-to-day diaries, as we all probably should have been doing last year.
Historians of the future will look at all of our tweets to see how bored we were. Watched Bridgerton again.
Tiger King. But what we do have are kind of endless first-hand accounts, you know, from the time in the newspapers and sometimes surprising places like the Dáil. I mean, you had a TD in Galway, for example, complaining that, you know, hordes of people from Cork were coming to the West on their summer holidays. And they paint this real picture of fear. Mm. Cork notifies its first case the 13th of June. And by the second week of August 1956, 90 cases had occurred in the city, 34 in County Cork. And I think the word polio was a lot more familiar to Irish people than the illness was. It was kind of synonymous with America. You know, outbreaks were relatively common in the US, right across the country. And no one really knew how this thing spread. There were all kinds of theories that began to spread kind of leaside. Some people said it came with clothing that was sent from the United States, you know, relatives sending secondhand clothes across to the kids in Ireland. People said it came from pasteurized milk. It was spread by flies. It's really, really interesting to look at the Cork press in 56 and the theories people were putting forward for, you know, where this mystery illness was coming from.
It is, of course, it's worth stressing that it was relatively common in the US in earlier decades as well, because we're talking about the mid-1950s here. And in the mid-1940s, you had the death of the US president who was wheelchair-bound for a lot of his adult life, Franklin Roosevelt, as a result of polio. So it wasn't quite as totally unique as people might think. But nonetheless, Cork, in the midst of all of this, it goes into almost something comparable to our modern-day lockdowns. It's a total halt.
And it's a weird one because it kind of seems that people kind of self-imposed restrictions on themselves that went above and beyond the authorities. So there's a by-election in Cork in August 56, and there's really bad turnout. Like less than half the electorate actually go out and vote. The streets are empty, shops are empty, but they're not ordered to close. I mean, it's a real sign of fear. And given that the disease primarily affects children, school closures are brought in. And then some of the restrictions today seem kind of odd to us. So children under 12 years of age were not admitted to cinemas. So if you were, you know, 12 and a half, you could go to the cinema. But if you were 11 and a half, you couldn't. Like, they really, really didn't know how to deal with this. But what's interesting about it, when you look at the geography of Cork, is that the disease kind of, it ravages particular districts. And it's not necessarily those that you expect. Donal O'Donovan, who was a civil servant working for the chief medical officer in Cork, he writes that the majority of the cases occurred in the more well-to-do suburbs like Douglas and Bishopstown. And there was a suggestion that, you know, people that were exposed to poor quality water and to poor sanitary conditions in general kind of fared better. That, you know, kids in tenement blocks might have had some kind of immunity to this.
Okay.
So the idea that this illness was spreading through kind of suburbia, you know, among the middle class.
Yeah.
I think that really adds to the fear of it.
Sure,
and what is
the
United States in the mid-20th century is the most developed, you know, capitalist society in the world, and it's the epicenter of polio. So there's a real worry about where this thing spreads and how it spreads. And the Cork medical officer is on record as saying the higher the standard of living, the greater tendency towards the disease. Mm. So I think that is really part of the fear of polio, is the level at which it hits society.
You mentioned that people tended to adopt restrictions higher than what was officially recommended. That must have meant that it was a bit of a grey area from public health officials on things like travel in and out of the county.
Yeah, one of the very few good first-hand accounts of living through this is Patrick Coburn, the journalist, later a brilliant war reporter, fantastic war correspondent. And he writes in his memoir about it. And actually, he was caught up in this. He got polio. But he writes that in Dublin, health officials were getting themselves into a twist by simultaneously telling people it was perfectly safe to visit Cork, but at the same time saying they should not go there if they could possibly avoid it. So again, there's a little bit of our contemporary world in all of this.
Yeah, schools are safe, but sending people to school would not be safe, so we shouldn't do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. There were dozens of cases in Dublin as well. I mean, dozens of kids admitted to the fever hospital, which was in Cherry Orchard. There were almost as many cases of this thing in Dublin as there were in Cork in 56. But the media focus was very much, I suppose, on the smaller city, on Cork, and the fear of how it was spreading there.
Yeah, maybe it's because of how it was just talked about there as well. I mean, it's a little bit like how you've explained before why the Spanish flu was called the Spanish flu. It has nothing to do with, you know, Spanish origin. It was just because the Spaniards were the first ones to talk about it, and therefore everyone labelled it with them. The ventilator, and, you know, it's a much larger contraption than it is today, but unfortunately, much like it is today, had to end up becoming a saviour to an awful lot of people.
Yeah, the image I think that abounds in the collective memory from polio is the iron lung. What a name. And, you know, for patients whose muscles have been affected, these were basically enormous ventilators that you were put inside of with your head kind of sticking out.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Geary describes it great, a huge metal cylinder that operated like a pair of bellows to regulate breathing and keep patients alive. One survivor described the experience as similar to lying in a coffin with your head sticking out. And there are still people internationally, I mean, it's worth having a look at these things on YouTube if you've never seen one, who use these things, including one person in Dublin. So when I look at the iron lung, it's a big contraption, but it's basically the 1950s equivalent of the ventilator today. And it did the very same thing that the ventilator's done in the current pandemic. You know, it was crucially important for saving lives here and internationally.
Yeah. Let's then finally get on to the whole success story of this, the story of the rollout of the vaccine. And as I mentioned in the introduction, the role of Elvis Presley in getting people to take it.
Yeah, ultimately, the story of polio in Ireland and internationally is bound to the vaccine. And at the very same time that Cork was experiencing that massive trauma, there's this brilliant international breakthrough. Jonas Salk, we owe him so much, develops the vaccine in 55. And then in 56, they're really trying to up public confidence in it. So they administer it to Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show in America. And you get this great image of a kind of smiling, vaccinated Elvis Presley reprinted globally in the days that followed. That was really, really important in getting teenagers, especially, but, you know, young people and old people alike to take the vaccine.
Yeah.
And the numbers in America are incredible. I mean, between 55 and 57, polio cases in the US dropped 81%, 28,900 to 5,400. That's just a remarkable drop. But what I like about this story in the polio vaccine is the names. I mean, Pfizer took the lead.
Yeah,
they got the license. They were the first ones in. From the US government and the British military of health, Ministry of Health, to distribute the vaccine. So there's echoes, if you will, of now in it. And we went into the 1960s, a much healthier people than before. Mary Daly, the historian, she writes about how this vaccine came at a time when there was so much good happening in Ireland. Mortality from TB was falling, infant mortality was falling, fewer children were dying from pneumonia, and universal vaccination had largely conquered polio. So, you know, all these things came along at once and meant that the 60s were a much happier time in Ireland than the 50s had been.
I did not know about that Elvis Presley link, and I'm really tickled that when people remember Elvis Presley for going on the Ed Sullivan Show, and most people remember how they had to crop his legs out because, you know, his manner of gyrating dancing was upsetting a lot of the, you know, the great viewers, that actually at the same time he was performing a really, really vital international public health mission as well. Fascinating stuff, Donal. So timely as ever. Delighted to be able to give you a little bit of colour on a Sunday, because certainly you give all of our listeners some colour, and we're very grateful for that this and every week. Donal Fallon is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here To Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you'll find wherever you get your audio.